Every time David Shapiro and I get together, I think, oh my goodness, it's been so long. You know, Dave, we worked together for like 25 years. It's next, I worked out next of next year, as they say here in the Western Cape. It will be 30 years since we launched Business Radio in South Africa back at the SABC Dungeons, which you'll remember so well. But my goodness, your wisdom has just grown and grown, and more people want to know what you think about lots of things. And so it's hard to catch you, though, because you travel quite a lot nowadays with your family dispersed over the world, which I suppose does also give you a very useful insight into global markets, which are so important to us, aren't they?
It is. And you pick up the mood of the people around there. And I think that's very important. I've just come back from the United States, and it makes you think, you know, the people are walking around there, not quite sure of who they are, what they are, what America is. It's quite important. It's a nation that is completely split. So you pick up the mood from talking to people, how are they shifting? They don't like the left. They can't stand the left and they can't stand the right, but there's no one in the middle to guide them. So it's business still thrives there. It's still a very dynamic country, but you know, people just don't feel like they're Americans anymore. They don't know what that means. So you pick up those kind of moods from conversations with people.
And on top of that, you got Warren Buffett buying Alphabet shares.
Yes. I'm happy about that. Alec, I have to say one thing. I wrote an article, you know, me and Warren B. And it was great sadness that I read his Thanksgiving letter. And when I say sadness, genuine sadness. And the reason is that I don't think people appreciate what a personality is. You might not agree with his views. You might not agree with his philosophies, you know, or his business strategy. But as a person, he has to follow him and his philosophies and just his outlook on life, no one's going to fill that gap. No one, you know, that I can see. So it was really sad that he said, this is it, you know, this is my last letter. And even that was so filled with warmth and, you know, love. I my letter was around Rose Blumkin because he didn't mention it. And yes. I said, no, you know, she was a favorite. So I'm so sorry.
Tell us about her, Dave. Tell us about Mrs. B.
It's a wonderful, wonderful story because she epitomizes what he looked for in a business. You know, she was a young lady who came to America. She fled from, well, she followed a husband from Russia. He didn't want to be conscripted into the army. Now, she started working at the age of 6 in her grandmother's grocery store, and by 13, she had a few people, so I think about 6 people reporting to her, but she made her way across Russia to America into Fort Dodge, but then eventually moved to Omaha where she started to sell furniture in the basement, you know. And from that, those humble beginnings, and this is, I'll give you the important part, from those humble beginnings, she built up Nebraska Furniture Mart, which was, I don't know where it is today, but a few years ago, was one of the biggest furniture retailers in America. What defined her is that she couldn't read or write. Buffett came and made her, I think in the mid-80s, he made a bid for her business at $55 million, and she accepted. It was a one-page document that cost $1,400, but she accepted the deal. When he did stock, he found that the stock was worth $85 million, but she didn't go back on her word. She never went back on her word. And there are lovely stories around it. And he appreciated that. You know, she had done a deal and she stood by that. But I think what happened later, which is also a fascinating story, is that she was 96 still working. And her sons and the family were kind of ignoring her or sidelining her. And she said, I'm retiring. But she couldn't retire and then started in opposition. You know, she's got an opposition to Nebraska furniture.
At 96.
So damage at 96. They had to come and Buffett had to buy her out for $5 million. And she said, I want cash. No credit. I want cash. And, you know, which is a wonderful story. And he said, okay, we'll give you the cash, but we'll give you this deal, but I want a no-compete deal. You know, in other words, you're not allowed to compete with us. Okay. She continued working to 103 and died at 104. And he always warned his executives. Remember, he'd say, you know, don't retire. Look what happened to Mrs. B, you know, when she retired and that. It's a wonderful, wonderful story, which I think was, you know, full of humor, just full of warmth. And just for me, you know, typified what he was about and the people he loved and that were close to him in Omaha. We don't see stories like that now. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's also the reason why at BizNews we have a retirement age of 103, taking it from the Berkshire retirement age. Although he broke his own rule, didn't he, Warren, by actually retiring at, what, 96?
95.
Yeah.
95. He, 49, 30, August. Alec, I think he's feeling it. I think at the last presentation, you know, you could see he was stammering a little, struggling with memory, and I thought he's, you know, to him, he said, well, probably said, I can't do this. And I think that's why he made that announcement there and then and handed over to Greg Abel saying, you know, this is it. I think people weren't expecting that. But
is that the end, Dave? Are you going to go back to Omaha to the AGM with Warren not on the stage?
I don't think they can carry it like him. I don't. Alec, in those years that we used to visit, I used to make my own notes. So I never read books or anything, and I never read articles. I sat there and took down every word he said. And the wealth of information that I still have today that is relevant on investment, on his views on life and that, you know, his views towards children. I mean, you know, how to live their own life, not to live their parents' biographies, you know, and the whole thing of read, you know, don't do, kind of read Phil Fisher, read Benjamin Graham, don't do equations with Greek letters in there. You know, that kind of, and the whole thing is anybody came to him with a spreadsheet, you know, he just ignored it. So he taught us how to recognize good companies. And he'd say, just go for companies you like. You know, if you like a company, look into it and research it, you know, and look, what's it going to look like in 5 years' time? What's it going to look like in 10 years' time? And research it. And ignore the ones that you don't like. You know, you don't have to follow every company. So there are just hundreds of pieces of information, you know, that I still have on file, still have in presentations that are just so, so abundant with, you know, with guidance. And that's what I'm going to miss, you know. I love his humor, you know, and he was self-deprecating. He never, you know, we make mistakes. I always admit that. They never got everything right. And that's in today's world where it's so greedy, run by algorithms. You know, everybody looks, what's the market going to look like in the next 5 minutes? You know, that's our outlook. It's not, you know, we don't make long-term decisions. And to be in markets today, Alec, you've got to say, what's going to happen this afternoon? You know, you can't operate like that. And the sad thing is our clients, Alec, and this is where we've changed, and this is where we've changed a lot is that today clients walk around with their cell phones knowing on the minute how much they're worth. You know that? Now, when you've got clients like that, you know, who are judging you every 5 minutes, it's a whole new ball game. It's a whole new industry. Yeah.
Yeah, the world has changed a lot since David Shapiro first became a stockbroker. If you were to go back, though, Dave, back to the beginning, would you, let's just say you were a 30-year-old with 10,000 rand and you had the choice of doing anything, what would you have still gone into stockbroking? Or indeed, if you were 30 today, would you follow that, Ruth?
It's funny enough. I got in there by default. When I was at Wits, I was far happier on the football field than in classes. Or if I was in class, I was drawing my lecturers. You know, that was my attitude at that. But I think a lot of the blame was the lecturers, you know, and the system. It didn't teach us anything. It didn't mentor. And as I got in and started to learn more and became more comfortable, so I began to enjoy it. You know, and even now, I'm 78, Alec. I'm an old man, but I still get up 4:45 in the morning, you know, go to see what happened in Europe, I mean, what happened in Asia, what markets are like, and thinking, okay, is everything, you know, what we're holding, is it still relevant? What do I do? Is there any news? And I enjoy that part of it. I love the politics, economic side of it. You know, I'm not a great analyst in that. I don't like to delve too deeply and to develop, you know, three-dimensional spreadsheets. I just like to look for good businesses and say, okay, you know, where are things happening? Where should we go? Where's the excitement? So that's what keeps me buzzing and what I enjoy. And I must add to you, you know, I must add it to you when you say we're back 30 years. You've been hugely instrumental. And I'm not here to flatter you, but I think credit where it's due in actually bringing markets to people, making them understand markets. And you're still doing it, you know. It's wonderful.
Like a soapy breakup scene, selling your car can be an emotional experience.
Just how dramatic was the car selling experience?
Not dramatic at all. I did my research and We Buy Cars was by far the best price.
Very not dramatic. But I like drama.
I was standing there watching my phone, waiting for the money to get in, and there it was.
Yes. Car. Driving.
We Buy Cars. The easiest way to sell your car, by far.
I wouldn't mind a little more drama. Anybody bring me some tears?
It's so exciting, though, isn't it, to be able to live your passion on a daily basis and something that is so dynamic. I remember you said to me a little while ago about ASML, and I just took your word for it. I looked at the annual report, didn't really understand what the heck they were doing. Said, no, but Dave just loves this stock. We put it in our portfolios. I've just read a book called The Chip War, where they go into great detail about semiconductors, how it started, and this incredible company called ASML, who's in the middle of the whole semiconductor kind of universe. And there you are, Dave. You caught that one long before anyone else. And there's no way in 100 years, doesn't matter how much money that Donald Trump wants to throw at its competitors, that they're going to catch, well, certainly not for my money, they won't catch ASML. They have just done too good a job there. But that's, have you got another one of those for me, Dave? Or for the business tribe?
I must tell you a lovely story in because markets move. And the other one was NVIDIA, you know, NVIDIA, which we found making these kind of chips, which were used for graphics, which were used mainly for gaming. And in 2022, when Powell started to increase interest rates, oh, this was also the aftermath of COVID. Remember, during COVID, everybody was playing games and NVIDIA had this abundance of chips, which they couldn't sell. And NVIDIA in 2022 kind of fell 65%, you know, the share price. And everybody, we had it in portfolios and everybody was saying, what are you doing with NVIDIA? Why you got NVIDIA, you know? And you feel insecure and you say, okay, I better get out. And then what happened exactly 3 years to the day, or the ChatGPT comes in, 3 years, Alec. And suddenly, who's the poster child in our head is NVIDIA. And now everybody's saying, why haven't we got NVIDIA? You know, why haven't we got NVIDIA? But I think those are the kind of companies that I love. And you've got to, I like Jensen Huang. I don't know, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, but and I still follow it despite the fact that it's under a lot of pressure now. You know, I mean, people say it's overpriced, whatever it is, and competition will come. But that was another winner. That's just a phenomenal business, you know. And they're not going to stop making chips. And chips, sadly, you know, Buffett always used to say, remember, he would always say, and we were at the meeting where he would say, look, in 20 years' time, why aren't you in technology? I don't understand it. In 20 years' time, kids will still be drinking Coca-Cola and eating Wrigley's chewing gum. And Holden said,
you dare give your grandchildren Coca-Cola today. You know, you get taken out because of the sugar high. And every time I go buy some Wrigley's, you know, they break because they've been on the shelf for so long, they crack. So, and what it's been replaced with is your phone, you know, your phone. Kids, I've got a granddaughter now who's 18 months. She's in Australia. Look, she's coming here. But she picks up the phone and she does, you can't fool it. She goes to my son and my daughter-in-law's phone and picks it up and starts talking, you know, mimicking talking. So, you know, that's how things are changing. And that dictates that things change and you've got to adapt to this change, you know, to what's happening.
Now, you got this very famous competition, the Crystal Award, or the Crystal Challenge. Rather. I want a little bit of an insight here for next year. What stock as of today? And of course, you're going to change your decisions. But as of today, what stock should we go and do some homework on for the Crystal Challenge for next year?
You know, you've got to choose 5 stocks. Okay, and you can't sell. You can sell one. You can cash in one. But that's the beauty. And what I love is the people who won it were gold bulls. They bought 3 chaps, unconnected, bought 5 gold stocks and blew everybody out. It's strange. I'm not a gold bull. I'm not a gold bull. And I must state it. I used to deal in gold shares, but gold, I still think is break. And you've got David Melville, who's a great fan of yours.
No, but David, hang on. Archie's turning in his grave.
My dad, it's sad.
Mr. Gold.
He loved gold. And from the very early ages, when he joined the market in 1931, 32, I think the UK had gone off the gold standard and he got a job, but it was in the depths of the depression. And his whole life was around gold shares. But when I say around gold shares, not only did they trade in gold shares, trade in De Beers, but they used to promote it overseas. They would do these trips and they would promote gold shares to the Swiss, gold shares to, you know, in other words, selling South Africa to the world. And they had connections in New York, London tremendously, a huge amount of channels into London, but into Belgium, into Brussels, into Paris, into Zurich, into Geneva. And that was his life. He traded gold shares, for what was more than 60 years.
And the apple fell a long way from that tree, huh? As far as gold's concerned.
Yeah, things changed, you know, things. I loved gold mines. You know, remember Alec, in the 70s, during that time, the gold price was pretty static. It's only when Nixon took America off the gold standard or the exchange. I hope I'm getting the terminology. You know, you could convert your dollar into gold. He removed that. And only then did the gold price start to move, but at a very slow pace. Before that, it was at first $35 an ounce, I think, from Bretton Woods. And then later on became 42.2. They increased it. And today, America still values its reserves at $42.2. So they've got 8,000 tons at a cost price of $42.20, whatever it is. But I think we were great. What defined my early years in the market was that we were by far the resource capital of the world. And we dealt, you know, those middle boards that we had on the market when you walked in, all the gold shares and, you know, the platinum shares, the coal shares, whatever. It was such a thrill. And then the mining houses themselves. It was such an incredible market and we were so powerful. You know, we've lost that, sadly. You know, we could have kept a lot of it, but I think politics has taken us away from that. We're nowhere near that, those kind of things. We were a powerful nation. We were a powerful market and a very powerful nation in that. And I love that. I love going down gold mines. It was always an occasion to go down. I remember going down to South Wall and all of this. They were, it was a wonderful time, you know. But we have to change. We have to adapt.
It is an interesting reminiscing about that. But when you have a look at the stock market, the South African stock market as it is today, the gold shares have had a fabulous run recently on the back of a strong gold price. But you still more keen on the bigger mining groups, on the diversified mining groups, if I read you correctly.
I am, and they've underperformed. You know, if you look for the year, I think BHP is probably flat. South 32 is in negative territory. Anglo's is up because of the deal it's done with Teck, you know, because of the corporate deals. And also it had been sold down quite a lot. So that's the rest are, even Kumba has done nothing. So it's all been about the gold shares and credit, you know, credit to those miners. They've done incredibly well. The sad thing is neither Anglo Gold nor Gold Fields does anything in South Africa, save Gold Fields, I think, South Deep, but they're making their money outside of South Africa. Look, Pan Africans are out, Harmony's still okay. I'd love to get Peter Major. He'll tell me where the gold reserves are here and, you know, where we can make some. They're there. They're a lot deeper than we can get to, but that Witwatersrand Basin, you know, which kind of almost encompassed the whole of Witwatersrand and Orange Free State, you know, the gold's still at the bottom of the basin. But we only mine the peripheral, you know.
Yeah, so, the fringes. Now, Peter says that there's enough mineable gold in South Africa exists as the amount that we've taken out, and by far the most in the world. But he complains about the legislation, and he says you just got to get the regulations right. Are you seeing, Dave? I mean, we could go on a downward spiral now and about that. But are you seeing any light at the end of that particular tunnel? And I ask this because I'm suddenly seeing on the gas side, which has been disastrous if you think about it. Namibia and Mozambique have got the same resources we've got. They are pulling in hundreds of billions of dollars in investment, and they're getting ready to pull out gas. We have got Zippo happening in South Africa, but there are signs of life at last. Are you seeing any signs of life on the mining side?
I watch carefully, and sadly, not really. You know, nothing to get us excited about, and it's tragic because the money's there. The one thing the world is awash with money. There's plenty investable money, not necessarily from the Americans, all over the world. And you see it in Australia, you see it in Canada, you see it all over. There is money. And the problem is that we put obstacles in our way. And I always remember listening to an interview with, I think it was with Intel. I can't remember where the CEO said, you know, if you go to Canada, they roll out a red carpet. They say to you, what can we do for you to make your company successful? That was the attitude. I always remember this. Here we do the opposite. You know, we put obstacles. We say, yes, you want to come in here. This is how you're going to conduct yourself. This is who you have to employ. This is where you have to buy your goodies from, and so on. And I think that, to me, has been the biggest problem here. We don't encourage. We make noises, but when companies come here, we don't go out of our way to make them comfortable and to do things. And that's been the sad case of South Africa. Alec, if you break down the JSE today in terms of market cap, I think 80% of the companies that make up our market cap do less than 20% business in South Africa. In fact, I'm being very generous when I say 20%. You know, most of the JSE is foreign earnings.
It is sad. I was just reminded of every morning, like you, I'm also the member of the 5 a.m. club. And this morning, I had an interesting reading from Plato. He said, ignorance, the root and stem of every evil. Now, if you think about that deeply, and then what he said was that there are two types of ignorance, and the worst type of ignorance is of those people who are arrogant and thus believe that they have the answers and are not prepared to learn. So there's a whole lot of philosophical stuff in all of that, but it's also perhaps required of those like you who have the wisdom, who have the knowledge, to share this knowledge with those who don't have it, so that they can understand these things. I suppose just the way that the knowledge has been shared with the people in Pretoria, it hasn't landed. And I think it's starting to land, Dave. I think it's starting to land, but maybe that's because I'm an optimist. And I was hoping you felt the same.
I love that. I always give an example. And I know that my wife is going to listen to this podcast. But, you know, my mother-in-law, she was a Butuakho. She was an activist. Spent 3 years in Barberton jail. I mean, she was a commie, whatever. But she was honest. She was those were her beliefs. I didn't fully agree with it. You know, when we used to meet on Friday nights for dinner or something, I mean, you had to be present at the table. But what was interesting about her and what was interesting about her beliefs, and I always say that, she thought that if she marched on Pretoria and went to the union buildings, and went into the basement and opened the lockers or opened their safe, they would find diamond and gold and immense wealth. So there's still a massive gap in the way people think. They don't understand what economic value is. You know, I would say Malema's in the same situation as that. They don't understand how a country creates wealth. You know, what drives it? It's those businesses. You know, those factories that you go into that create jobs for the people, for the community, and so on. You know, mines were ecosystems. That was so important. A mine, a shaft, round the shaft, you had the concession stores, you had the chemists, the schools, everything. That shaft fed a whole industry. And that's economic growth. That's what we have to explain. And we can't get that message through. That's how you create wealth. It doesn't matter who owns the factory. Whether it's a green, yellow, purple person, it doesn't matter. As long as they're employing people who get money, who can send their children to school, and so on. That's the ecosystem. When you close a factory, it reverses. So that's the kind of message I try to get through to people. That's what growth is. It's not some diamonds hidden in a safe somewhere in the bottom of the union buildings.
Yeah, the view that South Africa was this incredibly rich place that just oozed wealth. All of it, all of the economic growth in this country was created by the effort of people across the board, not just those who did the pick and shovel work, but very much those who were directing it, and the capital, of course, that came in from abroad. So anyway, I think it's starting to resonate, it's starting to land, but just from your perspective, you recently said that your stock pick was South African long bonds. Now, for a man who's been in the stock market and with equities for half a century, how the hell did you make that change?
You know what, Alec? I still think it's actually a vote of confidence, because I don't buy products. I don't buy. I look at the long bonds, and I'm looking at the 2040s now. So we're at 25. So it's only a 15-year bond. Excuse me. It's clean yield, to explain. That's the yield. If you put money in today, that's the yield you would get. I'm not going then a yield to maturity and building in all the capital, getting too technical, but that's 9.5%. And I'm saying, hold on a sec. Inflation 3%. We're certainly going to try get it down to 3%. That gives you a 6.5% real return. Okay, you'll pay tax on it. You know, if you pay 45% tax, right, it still goes down to about 5.5-6%. That's still a pretty good return. And that goes through to 2040. And it's tradable. You want to get out, you get out. I still am recommending it. I've just read a letter now that we're writing to a client and telling him to say, just this, you want to warehouse your cash? Here's the way to go. And that's a very, very positive. You know where else is looking good, Alec? Are those property trusts. Growth Point was up 30% last year, and that's before the year. Vukile, the same thing. So when rates start to come down and, you know, we're seeing the market stabilize, I'm not a property man and I'm not a bond man, but they look attractive.
And I guess that's really a a big question for you, because I've been looking at the details of reports from companies recently. And if you were to take a sector, banks, industrials, resources, and property. And I looked yesterday at Harprop's trading statement where they're talking about a yield or a distribution growth of between 10 to 12%. 10 to 12% in the year. And they their trading update said that's solid. They're with it. They aren't making any adjustment to it. That suddenly became quite appealing to me, given that the shares are not overly expensive. What is your, if you were to take one of those four sectors, which is the one that you'd plump for 2026?
Four sectors. You know what I love. Okay. My favorite stock at the moment is Pepco. and you know why, Alec? Have a look what's happening in that market, in the banking market. You know, Capitec has just swamped over First Rand and Standard Bank. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little, but you know, we were always writing it down, always trying to knock it, and they just know their market. They've got, now they've been challenged. I love what Pep was doing. You know, I love what they do, and I love what's happening in that market. Tiger Brands going down and saying, you know, we don't need to go to the cash and carries anymore. I mean, cash and carries, you know, for informal traders. We're going to get our goods to the informal market. So there's a massive market underneath there, which is actually the biggest growth area. Even Investec, you know, they wouldn't take you unless you had 50 million rand account with them. You know, now they say, well, not so fast. You remember they wanted the doctors and the lawyers and the accountants and the engineers. That was their market. Now, okay, not so fast, because that's where there's massive growth. And I find that's where the excitement is in this market. So I think, yeah, first of all, we're getting that recovery, as you started to talk about. Well, it's stabilizing. It's stabilizing. So you're getting, the long bonds are looking attractive. Property is looking attractive. And I like that bottom end of the market. You know, the fight between Shoprite and Capitec and Pepkor and everybody for that informal market. I think that's probably the most exciting place to be here.
Tell us more about Pepkor and why. Why would Pepkor be a competitor to Capitec?
Because they, for the last few years, they've been focusing on the informal sector. And they've got this, you know, they're going to start a bank. And they've already got this app, or what this product called Flash, where they're enabling those informal traders to convert that, or giving them almost like tokens where they can go and spend it or save it or remit it. And they've been doing this for a long time, and it's suddenly becoming a major part of their business. And I always liked where they are. They are opening 25 stores a month now, this year. I said, where? I didn't know we had so many cities or towns or villages. But, from the early days of Rainer van Rooyen, when he used to have those Pep stores, you know, where the little kids would have those gray pants on and the white shirts and those black shoes and off to school. And it's always been something that I've loved. And I'm off to the game reserves, you know, on the weekend. And I love to drive up, you know, through Mpumalanga and everything. And there's always a Pep store. There's, you know, you always see the Pep stores and the cash builds and everything. Gives you such a great insight into, what's driving this economy now. So that still remains a big store. And I like Boxer. You know, I like Boxer as well, which is in fact, that's where the wealth of Pick and Pay is. It's all in Boxer. And poor old, I think, Sean Summers knows this, you know. So he's battling against, not against that. He's using that as cash machine. But I think that's the exciting part of the market. That's where development's taking place here. You know, that's where we've got to watch. But stable economy, I think you can't ignore, you know, the property sector, which has gone through a very rough time because of costs, you know, because of Eskom, because of those issues, starting to pick up a little bit. Maybe not in the big retailers, but there are pockets that you can make money on. I like, you know, and and I think gold's going to stay, Alec. This is not, you know, the gold price, I don't think is going to go down, and it looks like it wants to go better more, before it goes down.
It's so interesting, because you were very excited about technology before most people. And I can say this because we worked together on radio every night for so many years. I remember you getting really upbeat about stuff than the rest of the world were shaking their heads. Now this informal sector, that's something G.G. Alcock's been talking about for a long time. And it sounds to me like the penny has dropped with David Shapiro, who's saying, let's go with the informal players. And when David Shapiro moves in that direction, the crowd tend to follow at some point, not always immediately, but is it a similar trend to the technology trend that you went for some years ago?
I was still an AI junkie. You know, I love AI, but you know, it's a different market. I think there's always opportunity, you know, and that's why I'm saying in our market, this is where the opportunity is. I still follow tech in a very big way. But I think that you asked me about the Crystal Challenge, and I'm saying that South Africa, these are the kind of companies that I would look at. I like the trend. You know, I like that businesses are adjusting and going down to those kind of levels. And I think that's where the excitement is going to be. So you'll make money here. You'll make money out of our market. But you've got to do your research. You know, you can't just sit back and think this is going to fall in your lap. You know, you've got to be shrewd. You've got to do the reading.
Got to be in the right parts of it as well, and the right stocks there. Dave, you've seen all the problems, 1987, prior to that even, certainly 2008, the COVID crisis. Are you sleeping well at night, or are you starting to get a little worried? You know, lots of people talking about a bubble.
Nah, this is not a bubble. Dot-com was a bubble. Alec, you know that we've had, I think, a crisis every 2 years. You know, from 9/11, the Iraq war, global financial crisis, debt crisis, China crashes, you name it. And that's just part of what markets are. You know, you just have to adapt to these crises and work your way through it. So I don't lose sleep over these things. You know, you've got to assess it. Is this, you know what worried me? And these signs were evident in the dot-com bubble. You knew things were mad because everybody, you know, was banging on your door, buy me this, buy me that. We're not in that mania yet. Alec, you've got to read 1929, Andrew Ross Sorkin's book. Very, very, I think it's a brilliant book and gives you great insight into what happened there and also into the minds of those traders. And you know, the crash only came a few years later. But it's a very good history. I don't want to call it a history book. I'm going to call it a novel. But that was mania. 2000 was mania. And the 08, that subprime crisis, that was mania. Where you remember the strawberry pickers in California could go get a bond, 110% bond. And, you know, that was madness. And the kind of things that they created. What worries me, I watched that private credit market. Because while it's well controlled now, where there's money being made, you start to get the fringe players coming in and starting to also do it or try and do it. And that's where, and then they, in order to get competition, in order to make money, they start discounting and becoming reckless and not following the same kind of rules. And that's when you start to watch and get worried. We're not there yet. You know, we're nowhere near that yet. Or hope
not. It's a very good. A very good point. I recall so clearly and often share the experience that I had of the first bubble. It was in 1987. And literally, I was the bill of the ball at every single dinner party that I went to, even though, yeah, as this young guy who didn't know a hell of a lot, but everybody wanted to buy shares. And if you knew a little bit about shares, a little bit like the dot-com bubble as well, you knew a little bit about the internet, boy, were you popular. And you've been through the lot. And I'm delighted to hear that you are not losing any sleep over this one. But I need to ask you this very important question. We have met lots of chief executives. I'm not going into Marcus Huerster because we went off to go and see him when he was still, well, maybe honest. But he was still honest. His place in Weinberg and David... But who's the guy today? Who impresses you today of all the CEOs around today?
Locally here, I don't know. For me, it's a big worry. We've lost so many personalities, and it's a big concern. I like what people like Chart Kruger are doing, but there's no one who stands up that I feel really comfortable for. You know, I loved CMH. I loved, remember Cash Build, what's his name? Pat Goldrick, those kind of people.
Pat Goldrick. Mm.
I'm not sure today, Alec. And I say that in politics as well. That's why when Buffett went, I said, we need personalities. We need people who can come out and say it like it is and say it in easy understand and attack government or attack, you know, the establishment. I don't know. I have to think about it, but I do go through a lot of companies. You know, the AVI, but they're not personalities in a way that are going to change things and get out there and challenge it. I don't know. I'm struggling on that. I think we've got a pretty, this is going to cost me and this is going to, I think we've got a pretty dull bunch at the moment. I don't know.
We've made them dull. You know, maybe too many people have read Jim Collins, and Jim Collins says he likes it when you're under the radar and dull and don't talk about things. And perhaps too many CEOs have been taught that at their business schools or wherever, or maybe there are too many accountants who are CEOs nowadays. You know, where's the Brian Joffe? That kind of business creator, but they exist. They're around. You just got to look for them, I think.
I'm looking for them. I think we've lost a lot of personalities. A lot of them are away, you know, even in the
but no one jumps out at you. No one jumps out and says,
I should have gone and gone. You know, I still go through all the business. Every day I try to go through results as they come through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, when you go and look at some of the insurance reports that go through that, I mean, that's agony to go through. You know, it's agony to try and read and understand what they're doing and where they're going. I like Jeanette Maria at MPM. MPM, yeah. I think she's doing an incredible job turning that around. Suddenly, this was the ugly duckling. It's beginning to be a bit of a swan. It's done very well as well. Trying to think of other areas.
Insurance,
yeah, great company, good company. It's done nothing this year as well, but also something to be proud of. And they've done very well in Australia.
Mm. What's happened to Adrian Gore? He was almost a colossus at one stage. He seems to have made. Perhaps he's just quietened down.
I think it's very quiet. I think there are a lot of political battles in these businesses. You can't say too much, and you can't say, you know, it's very hard for them to really say anything. Yeah, I don't know, Alec.
Andres van Heerden? Andres from Afimat? Yeah.
Yeah, shame he's battling with his with the cement side of it. But he was great. I loved Afimat. I think they were always, they've gone off the boil now because of, I think, some of the acquisitions. They'll come back. I don't think they've lost the touch. But let's see. I don't know. Who's your favorite?
We shall see.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting time there. Just getting back to the AI story, because that is it's a good place to end with, given that it's so much in the headlines at the moment. Is the trade there becoming overcrowded? Now, I know we don't have much AI trade here in South Africa, but when you look globally, is it Palantir? We bought in our portfolios at $8. It's now nearly $200. So the tribe is delighted with that. But I'd love to find another Palantir somewhere. You just worry that, well, maybe that space is now becoming, you know, capitalism. You make excess. Yeah, you make excess money, and then something you get 100 people coming into the same area. Is that in AI not a problem?
You know, I think we had it with NVIDIA. You know, everybody when it went up to $80 or something, and I'm talking about after split, they said, oh, I've got to get out. I said, no, you know, you don't have to. And my test is, would I buy it for clients coming in today? Yes. You know, and if I'm going to buy it for clients coming, why must I sell it for the clients who've got too much of it? So it doesn't bother me. But Alec, I think you're going to be spoiled for choice. And that's, you've got to do your research
and be a little careful. But these, you know how big NVIDIA is? Okay, I'm going to tell you some of my research. Okay, I've got a friend called ChatGPT, and I always ask him questions. There's a particular person there who knows me there at ChatGPT. So I said, tell me what are, because I was fascinated by central bank buying of gold. So I said, what are the top 10 holdings? You know, in other words, which central banks are buying? There are 10 central banks that have got massive reserves. America leads with 8,000 tons. So I said, okay, take those top 10, which is the Germany's and China's and everything. I said, and value their gold holdings at $4,000 an ounce. You know what it came to? Just over $3 trillion. Okay. All right. Maybe $3.5 trillion. What's the value of NVIDIA? It's like $4.5 trillion. So the total gold holdings of the central bank, I don't know what's tucked under, you know, under mattresses, or some old ladies keep a checkers bag with millions of coins in the top of their cupboards or something. I don't know that kind of hoarding. But the gold holdings, that's not a lot. So the gold market is actually very, very small. The whole UK market, the FTSE. Now, what's in the FTSE? Rio Tinto, Anglo-American, BHP Billiton, Shell, you name it. You know how big that doesn't even equate to the market value of NVIDIA. NVIDIA is bigger than the UK market. So it gives you, why am I identifying doing this? It just gives you the size and power of these businesses. Apple's $4 trillion. Then you've got the alphabets in there. So they're huge businesses. They are mammoth businesses, and continue to generate a lot of cash, which gives them the muscle to keep ahead of the competition. They can spend developing new chips, you know, spend new businesses, which is very difficult for up-and-coming businesses as well. And that's why I still like these businesses. They are so hugely powerful. And it makes America as well very, very strong. As much as you might despise or dislike Trump, you know, this is America. And they just carry on, you know, because in a few years' time, he's not going to be there. So
People don't get that the guerrilla game in tech is that the bigger you get, the bigger you become. But it is another example of NVIDIA. If it was a country, it would be 12 South Africas. It's a bit scary, isn't it? So it is the 12 times South Africa's GDP if it was a country. It's quite scary.
That is scary. It gives you an idea. And I watch them daily. And the beauty, Alec, the beauty about markets today, and that's what I say to a lot of my clients, I say, if we don't like it tomorrow, we get out. You know, I don't have to make a decision today or now. You know, if I buy for you in the morning, I can get out in the afternoon. You know, that's the beauty of liquidity in markets. And that's why it's a big rule. You know, I always stay in liquid stocks that I can get out of. And so I don't have to make a decision today whether, you know, I don't feel it's a bubble today. Tomorrow, if I feel it's a bubble, we're out. You know?
There we go. You know what I'm trying to say? I was going to let you go, but I can't without asking you about crypto.
And I'm sorry. You know what I mean? I don't like people to lose money. I genuinely don't. And whether it's gold, whatever it is, I don't get delight in other people's misery in that. And I see it's coming under pressure now. And I think one of the issues that worry me about the market is that there were too much promotion. People were promoting it. And when you promote it at that kind of price, you can't buy the full coin. So you gear up. And that's the worst thing, because as it reverses, as we see, it means you've got to unravel that. It's like buying a house. And, you know, you've got a mortgage and suddenly the value of the house falls, you know, you're underwater. And I think to a large extent, some of the weaknesses that we saw in NVIDIA and some of the tech came as a result of that. So I don't wish harm on anybody, because I think somewhere down the line, we're going to be using tokens or crypto, or there's going to be some new way of moving money. But I don't understand it, you know. I always explain, I like a balance sheet, you know, because I like to go to NIP, you know, even in process analysis, I fight with people about that all the time. But because I go to the balance sheet and I go to the income statement and I read and I say, nah, you know, And that gives me a view. And that's what I like to do. But I can't do that for crypto and I can't do that for gold.
So you've opened a door with Process and NicePass. You don't like?
No, I like it. I like it.
Oh, you like it?
Because of Tencent, but not because of the delivery box. You know, chaps running around delivering pizzas at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I like to create arguments because when I look at their income statement, they, you know, it comes from the sale of Tencent shares and from the from earnings from putting their earnings in 20% of Tencent's earnings. So that's NicePass. The rest is loss. So if you take what they're doing on all the other businesses and you take a cost, take out those two statements. And that's why you've got to go look at the income statement itself. And I like to fight and I get a lot of people throw apples at me, you know, rotten apples and eggs and everything. But I buy it because of Tencent, but not because of everything else. I think people are paying themselves lots of money for those businesses. And they're not, I just don't get excited about it. I would have preferred.
Give Fabrizio Bloisi the thumbs up. You're still giving a little judgment out on him.
He's a good manager, but I just don't think that it's going to take generations for those businesses to play catch up with their holding in Tencent, which is still the big gorilla in that room. Everything else is, they're still in losses. I mean, big losses. If you take what they're earning on all those other businesses, even though they're improving, and you take the costs of running all of those, still a big negative. So I think Adrian Gore's got the same problem with all the other things. Eventually, you pay every day, you're paying to keep these businesses going. You know, somewhere down the line, you've got to recover all of those things. So this is accounting 101. So that's why I like to look at a balance sheet. I like to look at the income statement, not what the PR people say. You know, I like to go down to break it up line by line. So Fabrizio is a good man. He's been, he's running nice businesses, but they're not going to move the needle on Process and NicePass.
David Shapiro is a chartered accountant, I'll remind you, so he knows all about the numbers. He's not going to be fooled by any fancy PR talk. He's also South Africa's favorite stockbroker. And I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.